We're entering the Bitcoin golden era with all the new technologies we're discovering. Because for the first decade, Bitcoin was still very, for at least for the first 5, 6 years, there was so little capital in the industry that not a lot was getting built. Plus, Bitcoin still had all these early on issues. Now we're getting to the moment where Bitcoin is extremely solid. It's more than it's a $1 trillion industry, right? Or a $1 trillion asset. So I think we're just entering the golden era.
What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anyone else you know. We have Gustavo on the show today from Aureo. Now, he is in Mexico City, and he has started up. This guy has a list of things that he's been building and projects he's been involved in that's a little bit crazy over the years. He's been in Bitcoin for 8 years. And Aureo is a super exciting Bitcoin-only service with a Bitcoin banking, fiat banking bridge. And he is involved in the Bitcoin space, the Casa de Satoshi in Mexico City. He has been with Bitcoin Optech. He's worked with Verify. He's worked with Wasabi and Bull Bitcoin. Like, this guy has a long history and knowledge on the Bitcoin culture and the Bitcoin tech over the years. And really, one of the most fun things we get about in this episode is kind of his entrepreneurial mindset and his founder mindset of the principles and goals you have to take in or you have to hold on to while building something for the long term so that you actually have a chance of reaching that end goal and staying on mission, I guess you could say. So we will get right into it. A quick thank you to our amazing sponsor. We have Shift Crypto and the Bitbox Nova. I've got the shell here in my trash, but this is the new Bitbox, new version, latest version of the Bitbox. You can plug it right into an iPhone, into an Android, right into your MacBook. And I've always been impressed with their full, like the intuitiveness and the ease of using their entire stack to go from like not holding your own keys to being a sovereign Bitcoiner. And I've been recommending Bitbox for years, for literally a long, long time. I love the team. I love their product. I've got like, I don't even know, four of the things. I have a lot of them, and I have little crypto cloak cases, which are really, really dope. And the new one fits inside the crypto cloak cases, just so you know. And so check that out. I have a discount code, Guy, and my affiliate link right down in the show notes that also really, really helps out the show. So, you know, you can save your sats with my discount code. You can save your sats by putting them on a Bitbox and keeping them safe. And you can support my work and Bitcoin Audible just by checking it out right down in the show notes. And with that, let's get into today's episode. This is Building Instant Fiat to Bitcoin Bridges with Gustavo from Aureo. Gustavo, welcome to the show, man. Welcome to Bitcoin Audible. How you doing?
I'm doing really good, man. Thank you for having me.
Awesome, yeah. So I've been keeping an eye on a bunch of projects that I've been making lists or whatever, and been talking to my producer a lot as well on just like new entrants into like the various business opportunities and the basically expansion of the markets and stuff, and providing unique or very targeted benefits or services, right, in the Bitcoin space, because there's an interesting disconnect, I feel like, between a lot of the things that people want to build and what really the people on the ground need, you know? And so why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and then kind of your background, how you got into Bitcoin and getting into the things that you're building, before we kind of get into the nit and gritty and specifics on some of the things that you've released recently that kind of caught my eye.
Perfect. Thank you. Gee, this is really an honor to be here. So my name is Gustavo. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Audio. Audio is a Bitcoin-only platform in Mexico and in Latin America to buy and sell Bitcoin, similar to the models that we've seen in the United States, such as Reverse One or Strike. We're trying to reproduce the same thing in Latin America. So I've been working on Bitcoin for 8 years already. This is my second startup. I was born in Peru, but I grew up in Montreal, Canada, where I encountered Bitcoin about a decade ago. And I was very tight with the Bitcoin Montreal community to the point where I became a co-organizer of the meetup from 2018 to 2022. However, during COVID, because I had already been introduced to Bitcoin and to freedom-related ideas, COVID in Canada hit really hard. I mean, the actions of the government in Canada hit us really hard. So I moved to Mexico, and I've been living in Mexico for the past 5 years. And Audio is now the startup I have founded in Mexico. After, you know, coming from Canada, the industry is very developed, like in the United States. And when I got into Mexico, I saw how many things were missing. So I just wanted to continue the mission down there. I have worked, like I said, at Verify, which was a platform similar to Audio to buy and sell Bitcoin, exclusively Bitcoin in Canada. Then I worked at Bull Bitcoin for about a year. I've worked at Wasabi Wallet until it shut down, mostly on the product and marketing side of things. I'm also a software developer. And after Wasabi, I co-founded Audio, which used to be called Swapito. I'm also a co-writer in the Bitcoin Optech newsletter and a host of the Casa Satoshi Bitcoin Meetup in Mexico City, which is what I believe the biggest Bitcoin meetup and physical space in Mexico, in the whole country of Mexico.
Whew, that's a resume. Oh yeah. So you actually moved from Canada. Did you move because of the COVID stuff?
Yes, 100%.
Oh wow. What was the kind of like straw that broke the camel's back there? I think a lot of people kind of woke up, like even my brother's wife went to Canada, left Iran and went to Canada in hopes of like trying to find some semblance of freedom. And then COVID happened and she was just like, oh God, but she was still stuck there because she's from Iran and nobody else wants her. Cause she was born on the wrong plot of dirt apparently. And, it was wild. She got, because most of her social circle did not share her opinions about it. And they like basically ghosted her. So she's like, no family, no anything. I'm curious, like what it was that kind of shifted your perspective. Like what was the big thing that stood out is like, oh, I got to get the hell out of here. As opposed to just like, oh, I gotta find a better place or I gotta, what's the isolate in place or whatever it is, you know, like what's the one that made you say, I gotta leave. I'm done here.
It was the vaccine passport. And it was not just a vaccine passport to go to stores. It was the fact that they had set a date for if you didn't get the vaccine passport, you cannot enter a plane, a train. You cannot even cross the US border. So I was like, wow. If I'm not out of here by this date, I'm going to be stuck here. And it was also, it had also been the second year they had done curfews for months, from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., you know, so it was on top of everything, right? Or like seeing things like on the day of Christmas, seeing public service announcements about if you see your neighbor inviting his family home for Christmas, make sure to call this public number and report him, right? So he can get fined. So things like that, you start to see, and the weirdest thing is when you talk to people you knew, you went to school, your family, and they all seem like robots, just repeating the same story, right? So you're like, okay, this is getting out of hand. So it was a whole like year and a half of built up, but the vaccine passport really really cut it for me. I had already been exploring. I went to Costa Rica, I went to Mexico, so I already knew, okay, I got these options. But then when I came back for the summer and it was the whole narrative around the vaccine passport, it was over for me.
Wow. How long had you been in Canada?
I moved to Canada when I was 8 years old with my family. So I had lived there for about 18 years.
Oh, wow. Wow. So that was basically home for you.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Of course. And, you know, mm-hmm. I had a lot of luck because I found the Bitcoin community early on when I was like 19, 20. So by the time COVID hit, I was already surrounded by freedom-minded people.
Yeah. You were like preconditioned to be like to see the writing on the wall before exactly. It became too bright. Mm. That's crazy, man. I didn't realize they had set like a date of like you can't even get on a plane.
Yeah.
Most of that's been walked back or loosened, pretty much. Obviously, well,
yeah.
Obviously, because my brother and I have been. My brother's in Canada, and I have been in Canada, and his wife is in Canada. So there's some degree of like loosening of it, but still, it's crazy that it got to that point. It's so wild how quickly it went into like a full totalitarianism, you know?
Yeah.
Like just like a practical martial law, curfews and all of it on such an insane, like the COVID cases have barely even moved and like nobody even thinks about that. It's like, you know, COVID cases are, it's like, oh, it's this whole so huge, horrible thing. But then it just became like not newsworthy anymore. And it was like, oh, it's the flu again, because like the 60,000 people who died from the flu, suddenly there were zero flu cases for 2 years. That makes perfect sense. Right.
Right.
The number of inconsistencies and just like, I am shocked how many people are still. Like, still just believe the narrative. Like, what is it? What does it take to wake up? You know, did you have friends like that? I mean, you said you already were in the Bitcoin community and stuff, but did you have friends in kind of the normie friends,
of course.
If for lack of a better word? And how did you, do you have any encounters or things that you remember from that of just like, oh, God, what? You know, what do I do? What do I do with these people? Like, how do I help? That's like, I feel helpless. There are still people to this day. And I feel helpless because I care about them. I think they are good people, but holy crap, they're deluded. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, no, it really is like that. It really is like that. So I came from a family of doctors. Both my parents and my big sister are all three doctors. So for them, it was really like, we got to listen to what these yeah. big doctors yeah. say, right? They cannot question that, because it basically, if you're a doctor and you question that, you're basically putting all of your belief system into question, and you're yeah. going to have to face a harsh
That's
reality.
That's a who you are problem.
Exactly.
Like, who do I identify? Who am I as a person? Like, that's crazy.
Exactly. So there was that. But what my family, I think they did a lot of pushback with me then. Now they kind of seem to have understood it. But if another situation like it came around, right, would they react the same way? Probably. Right. But I would tell you the biggest shocker was with people that I went to high school with. And I was yeah. like, you guys, we studied totalitarian regimes together. And you yeah. would say how you would never fall for that sort of narrative, right? And now that is exact, and you cannot see the irony behind it when you say, and they just couldn't, right? And now some people are digital, don't want to talk about it now.
There's too much cognitive dissonance, and they know that if they get into it, they'll have to see how wrong they were.
Exactly.
And so like there's a vicious like settled anger that like some people like I know that you can't even bring it up. Like they cannot mentally deal with it.
Exactly.
And they just freak out. And it's like did you never stop and wonder what that cognitive dissonance is? Like why you feel that way about it, you know? Like you should always go towards the things that you are most uncomfortable about because you should recognize that that is a thing telling you that you don't know, that, you know, you fear the unknown. So go know, go learn it. Like, just like, why are you, oh man, It's so frustrating because it's like, why are you afraid to go become right. something different than you are? You know, it's not like who's got it figured out. Anybody got it figured out? You know, like go learn something. Go debate and defend what you actually think. And if you can't, recognize that maybe what you think is wrong. Like everybody's been wrong forever. Why are we so insecure about being wrong? Like I'm wrong about shit all the time. You know what I mean? How much BS 100%. I've probably spouted on this show? But I figured out, you know, like that's the whole point. And usually somebody calls me out on it or they'll point me to something that's actually interesting that I'd never dug into. Like, good God, there's a billion times the amount of things to actually learn and expand on than anything we could ever learn. So of course you're wrong. Of course you're wrong about everything.
Of course.
I don't know.
No, I totally agree. And I also think it speaks to the culture of Canada. Canadians are very proud of being obedient. You know, they're polite, obedient.
Sorry.
Very different from the United States, right? So you don't...
What are you talking about?
you kind of have that idea that like, okay, so if my government was lying to me, which is something that the Americans ask themselves all the time, but here in Canada, it's kind of taboo to think like that, right? So if you're like, oh, then, and it just breaks your whole sets of beliefs apart, right? I think people are scared to walk into that, out of their comfort zone, because then they would have to put into question all their beliefs, which is the right thing to do, and which is very related to Bitcoin. Right. You gotta, to understand Bitcoin, you basically have to put into question everything you've learned before. But yeah, I guess everyone, takes their time with it. Some will stick with this.
Some will never.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what was the first thing you did when you got to Mexico?
I travel a lot. So I lived in like 6 different cities in Mexico. Puerto Vallarta, Playa del Carmen, Querétaro. So a lot of beaches versus the center of Mexico. I also tried to, very early on when I moved to Mexico, I wrote about 3 articles about Mexico. The first was about like all the Bitcoin communities there were and everything that related to Bitcoin that there was in Mexico. So there was very little. I would tell you, compared to what we have today, Mexico was basically like, one crypto exchange, Bitso, and just crypto narrative around everything, right? So now there's actually a Bitcoin narrative. So yeah, so I was trying to understand what was going on with Bitcoin in Mexico when I got there, and which led me to understand how much work there had to be done.
Yeah. What do you think is still most needed kind of in the Spanish community? Because I've been thinking about this for a while. Honestly, we haven't been able to put much work toward it in the last month or two. But you met, you know, Johnny, my producer. We've talked about and we've like kind of laid out some workflows to get a Spanish Bitcoin Audible, right? Like a Spanish version of the show in my voice. But they're all, you know, they have their, like, they're not bad. They're not terrible, but none of them are great either. AI, I'm surprised by. And, you know, some people tell me I'm just not like looking at the right tools and be like, oh, you got to check this one out. You got to check this one out. But still, there's always been something missing from each tool. But I'm curious, like, what do you think, you know, this is why you created Aureo, I assume, is that you felt, you know, with Bitso and the crypto community or the crypto narrative being the only one there, is that that's a huge thing that they needed. What is still needed, you know, like, because the Spanish speaking community is like, you know, second biggest in the world, right? It's interesting how big the chasms still are between, you know, different linguistic communities, and different cultures and stuff in the world. Like, you know, I don't know anything that's happened in Latin America generally, you know, every once in a while I'll speak to somebody like you who's actually there, or has some sort of connection to it. And I'll just find out a whole bunch of stuff. I was like, I had no idea. I had no idea. I assume it's just like the U.S. because I speak to English-speaking people, you know? So maybe unpack what you see as like, where's the chasm that needs to be filled for either something that you want to build or for something that other people could step in and be like, oh, we should build this, you know?
Totally. Thank you for asking that question. So I think the first thing to understand is how different each individual country is in Latin America and how different Bitcoin should be approached in these countries. Like, for example, if you look at Venezuela, Argentina, you're looking at it from an hyperinflation perspective, right? Capital controls, hyperinflation. Mexico is the complete opposite. The Mexican currency has been basically at the same exchange rate to the US dollar since about more than a decade ago. So, and it has even performed better than the US dollar most of these last years, right? So you wouldn't think
Wow.
that. But you gotta understand and Mexico has absolute no capital controls, right? You can move money in and out the country without any limit. People are not that concerned about currency depreciation. So you just gotta take a different approach to it. What are people concerned about mostly in almost all of Latin America, I would say, is instability and government corruption and control. Right, that is a like something people tell us all the time right now. It's like I'm just very worried that the government is gonna seize my assets, so Bitcoin makes sense because it's completely unseizable. Right, that's one way to understand it. So I think that's the first thing: understand the country, understand the people you're dealing with, understand also the social dynamics and segments of the population. For example, if you go to Uruguay, you have a very equal society. If you go to Mexico, you have a very unequal society. So that is also a big factor to understand how the country works. Once, but let's say if we talk specifically about Mexico, I think what is missing is still not just education, but actually communication of narratives to push against the ideas Mexicans have about Bitcoin. If you, for example, if when we, my co-founder, he makes a lot of noise on Mexican Twitter, and he gets answered a lot that Bitcoin is simply a scam, because I think some studies say that about 10% of the population in Mexico thinks they've invested in Bitcoin, but they've actually invested in a Ponzi that brands itself as Bitcoin investment. This is actually a very common tactic in Latin America. A lot of Ponzi say, invest with me, we're going to invest in
We
Bitcoin
love Bitcoin,
mining.
buy my shitcoin.
It's even worse than shitcoins. It's like, it's not even, it's a Ponzi website that tells
It's a
you that
literal
you're.
just centralized website that tells you you're
Exactly.
getting it and it has
Exactly.
nothing to do with it.
Exactly.
Wow.
Latinos are, honestly, Latinos fall a lot for these scams. Even in the United States, all these MLMs, multi-level marketing and Ponzi schemes, they prey a lot on the Latino communities. So that is like an image that people have of Bitcoin, is that it's simply a scam, right? Because their cousin invested in a Ponzi and they associate Bitcoin to it. I would tell you that is very prevalent and
Wow.
amongst all levels of society. And then people that are actually that have looked into it, they just cannot make the difference between crypto and Bitcoin, right? So I for us that has been really the idea. How can we push against this and separate Bitcoin from all these Ponzi's and remove and educate on this, but also create a narrative around the fact that Bitcoin and crypto are just not at all the same thing and have nothing to do one with the other. So I think it's really about education, content, going on media, even traditional media, and putting a voice out there to actually represent what is actually happening and not just these fake ideas about Bitcoin.
Are you seeing progress in that direction? Like, does it feel like it's moving in the right direction, or does it feel like fighting against the tide?
I would tell you right now we're in a bear market, so it does feel a bit like fighting against the tide, but I'm very optimistic that once the exchange rate goes back up, we'll start to see some serious advances because we're already seeing the like more output from the Bitcoiners in Mexico. For example, like I said, we have this big community in Mexico City, but about six different communities have popped up over the country over the past 2 years that are Bitcoin only, driven by mission-oriented Bitcoiners. So plus
Nice.
you got a few, like we're not the only Bitcoin-only startup in Mexico. There's a few more that are popping up too, right? So I'm seeing the signs that a lot is that there's potential here. Plus, I also think that the crypto people are facing some harsh realities on their end, right? They're starting to question even whether, for example, Ethereum has any value. I don't know if you saw that the host of one of the most popular Ethereum shows called Bankless, he even said 2 weeks ago that he sold all his Ethereum. He still has Bitcoin, but he has completely given up on the idea that Ethereum could be a reserve asset. So that is also creating an opportunity for people like me and communities like ours to basically present our ideas in a moment where these people are asking themselves questions and looking for answers.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really funny. I watched a Hoskinson, just a clips cut together, right, of Charles Hoskinson talking about some early things, talking about how like Bitcoin doesn't have smart contracts and Bitcoin doesn't have this. You can't put snarks in Bitcoin, or like it's just going off on all of these like wing digits and like fancy sounding things, and how Bitcoin can't do all this. So how in the world would Bitcoin win? And it's so funny that like how quickly in the kind of the burgeoning crypto era, I realized that not only do those things have nothing to do with the security or trust in the money, but that those were actually net negatives. Like the more you could do with it, the less trustworthy it actually is. You have a larger, basically, surface. And that you were talking about, or that he was listing a whole bunch of things that it's a perfect demonstration of the mistake between tech, or the false equivalency between tech and money. Because it is a tech. Right? Bitcoin is a technology, but it is a money first. It is technology for the capacity to create money. And crypto thinks of it like a website. They think it's an app, right? And so if your app has fewer features than the other app, your app is going to lose because our app is better. And it's a complete failure to understand what industry. It's like people in finance thinking that they know money. Like I know what a good money is because I'm in finance. No. You know derivatives, you know financial engineering. You don't know jack about money. You might not know the first principles about money. Money is its own thing with all of its own characteristics and its own principles. It's completely as separate from finance as chemistry is from construction. Like they have nothing to do with each other. And it's wild to see like the level of conflation and ignorance, you know, which obviously they go hand in hand, right? You conflate it with something you think you understand to try to make sense of it. But, and maybe this is just kind of a general comment on the profound ignorance that everybody has about what money is. But it's funny that it's finally coming around, right? As what's his face from Bankless selling all of his Ethereum, because it's like, what are you gonna do with it? You know, you thought you were gonna create like a new hyper Visa app network, and turns out nobody cares. Like they care as long as they can bet on the casino, and then that dries up, and what do you got left? Something that's not really secure, something that has already been compromised like multiple times in its history for any sense of trust, like decentralized trust. And you still have this money over here that's just been working this whole time. I think it's just one of those things. I'm curious your thought on it as somebody who's putting a company out in the Bitcoin only narrative, especially upstream or swimming against the current, so to speak. I feel like it's just time, really, is the only thing that actually fixes it, is that it just becomes the default to, you know, Bitcoin just wins out of survivability. Like after everything else fails, it will still just be there.
Well, I couldn't agree more with everything you said. And, you know, I think the first thing to understand between the difference between money and tech is that you can copy tech, right? And that's the hardship these guys are facing.
Is you that can all, copy tech, that's right.
All these other cryptos, they're just copying the tech of the first ones like Ethereum. So you find yourself basically fighting against copycats where you cannot copy trust, right? And Bitcoin, you cannot copy the trust that requires for a monetary system to win. I agree. It's really just about time, right? But I also think we can make efforts towards just directing people that people that are asking themselves questions, be present for them at that moment, right? For example, in Mexico, what are those questions? Everywhere in the world, people are asking themselves some questions about what is really going on with this global situation, right? Why is Iran accepting Bitcoin for toll payments, right? These questions get asked more and more. And I just see them as opportunities to actually make a presentation, and maybe I'll convince 2 out of 100, right? I don't need to go for the big crowd. I just need to be there in front of people that actually are asking themselves the questions and want to are open to putting into question their beliefs and actually understanding things of how they are, right? Or for example, in Mexico, like I said at the beginning, a big concern is government authority, because now we're undergoing, if you know Mexican history, it was basically a one-party state for the whole 20th century. And it has had like 20 years of multi-parties. From 1920 to 2000, it was a single party state. And now we're going again in the same direction. The new party in power is again making Mexico a one party state. So people are very worried. They're like, okay, what is going to happen here? Are we going to hit? So that's also an opportunity to tell people, yeah, well, your bank account can absolutely be seized. And even all the other assets you have, they're just based on government authority and trust, which can be rug pulled from underneath you at any time, right? And Bitcoin is different. So I think that in the end, yes, it's just going to be time, and the world is changing and Mexico is changing. But if we can present these ideas in front of the people that want to hear them, I think that's the best we can do. And of course, that's what you've been doing.
Yeah. So with RAM, this is probably a good segue into the direct wallet thing, because this is really interesting. And there's an element of things that you can do with Bitcoin that obviously you can't do with anything else. And I felt like a lot of this has been like really underserved, and most of the finance and like banking side. And I'm not even saying this is like on purpose. I think a lot of it actually has to do with the cost of scams and the huge burden of regulation of like, can you track this, or how do you report this, or how do you KYC this? Aside from that, I'll just put a pin in that and we'll come back to how it relates. With REO, you've got this, basically you've got banking for explicitly for Lightning. Basically lay out this tool for the audience, because this is really cool. And I would freaking love this if like Fold or somebody adopted it, and I might tag Will Reeves in this and then, you know, complain at him or whine at him just a little bit in DMs and see if we can get this.
Of course, they should do it. So the idea of Audio started when I came to Mexico and I didn't see any Bitcoin only solution. So we decided to build it from the things we've learned in Canada, in the US, right, and all of our experience. And this new product that we came out with, Direct to Wallet, it basically allows you, so maybe to take a step back, we also got to look at what the Mexican banking system is. Mexico actually has a better banking system than the US and Canada. It's an interbank system that works at the central bank level and is completely instantaneous. So as soon as you send a bank transfer from one bank account, it routes a message to the central bank, and the money lands, whether it's $10 or $100,000, it all basically lands within seconds. So we understood that if we were able to connect this instantaneous bank account system with something like the Lightning Network and even the Bitcoin Network, but specifically the Lightning Network because of how instant it is too, then we could provide a pretty sleek experience. So that's what we built. Direct to Wallet is a way for us to assign an individual bank account number to each of our users that is unique to them, And as soon as pesos hit through the banking system to that specific bank account number, if the user has specified a wallet, then we'll just send the Bitcoin to that specific wallet, right? And that can be a Lightning or an on-chain wallet. But it's really magical when you use the Lightning Network, because like I click on send bank transfer and the money arrives in my Lightning wallet approximately like 30 seconds later, right? So that's the first thing we built. That's what we call direct to wallet. And I mean, if you use on-chain, yeah, you should change your address every time you use it. We still haven't arrived at a point where silent payments allows you to not reuse addresses, right? But still have a static payment instruction. But with Lightning addresses and LNURL, and eventually Bolt 12, you can have a static address that doesn't compromise your privacy. So you could just never log back into Audio. Just go on your bank account, or actually set on bank apps a monthly transfer. So every first of the month, 10,000 pesos comes out of your bank account, gets sent to Audio, and it just stacks in your Lightning wallet automatically, right? So you don't even have to sign in or log in into Audio except for the first time. And that is direct to wallet. And now last week we launched direct to bank, which is something similar, but on the opposite direction. So instead of assigning you a bank account number, we assign to you a Lightning address, which you can fully customize. For example, gustavo@audiobitcoin.com, and you link it with a bank account. And as soon as Lightning Bitcoin hits that Lightning address, you get pesos in your bank account within 30 seconds too. So now we have completed the full flow.
That's crazy. You know what's funny? I would actually feel like that side is easier, is going from Lightning to direct to pesos in the bank account, just because you don't have to worry about chargebacks. What do you do about chargebacks on the banking side?
Yeah, I would tell you that the system we have in place in Mexico has less chargebacks risk than the ACH system in the United States. So we haven't had any issues with chargebacks. The provider still like forces us to keep like a 24-hour reserve because potentially there's a risk
just
for chargebacks.
Case. Yeah.
But like chargebacks on bank transfers occur they occur 100 times less in Mexico than in the United States. So it's extremely unlikely.
Oh, that's a huge difference. I would have thought like 5 to 10 or something, because I just know it's bad in the US. But is that a vague like kind of estimate, or is that about accurate?
No, from what I recall, maybe I'm remembering correctly.
Sure, maybe there's a gap, right? Like, you know,
but it was outlandishly different, right? Because you got to think about first
that's crazy.
That this is one of the core things that I understood moving from Canada to Mexico, is about how the society perceives trust, right? In a country like Canada, trust is implied at the institutional level, right? And even at the cultural level. In Mexico, it's the complete opposite. There's no trust in institutions. There's no trust between people, right? From the moment you're a kid, you get told you cannot trust the government. You cannot trust anyone on the street, right? So chargebacks, in my opinion, are like, yeah, you can try to tell the bank, hey, but the bank's not going to trust you, and they're not going to allow you to claim back your funds. So yeah, it occurs way, way less. There's less process and less institutional trust.
That's crazy. As you know, like there's part of me that, you know, trust is kind of the foundation of society, right? Like you have a thriving society in a high trust environment, but it's like that very environment is exactly what produces like scams. it's exactly what produces the capacity and kind of the industrial scale ability to violate that trust. It's like a honeypot, you know? And it's really interesting. Granted, if you have like proper systems in place and you have a proper culture in place, you can actually, you know, keep this at bay for a long time, but cultures rot too. You know, people grow up in prosperity, and they just have no contrast, right? They don't even know. They think, oh, I've got it so hard because Facebook censors my posts or something, and they just have no idea what that even means in the context of like real problems that people have as they sit in their Starbucks and like talk to their friends on, you know, whatever their choice of 30 different applications and on their working on their MacBook. Is you lose perspective. You lose perspective. And so like part of me like feels like as trust breaks down in institutions, like I know things will be more chaotic in the US, and they have been and will continue to be probably for a generation. But it's also like this reassurance. It's also what gives me hope for the future, despite the fact that I know it's going to get worse first, is that what we've placed our trust into liars, like into pure corrupt liars, you know, like they just, and they don't even hesitate about it anymore. In fact, they kind of openly talk about the prevailing ideology. The establishment really doesn't even bat an eye at the idea of saying like, oh no, we should lie, because otherwise you could tell the truth. If you say facts in a certain way, it could make people think differently. It could make people not agree with us, because there are a lot of very inconvenient facts. So it makes sense that we should lie, or we should manipulate these statistics, or we should cover up this data. And they don't have a problem with it. The culture is so rotten that this is totally okay with them. And trust is such an interesting, you know, prosperity is its own, like it's like a feedback loop. It's like that cycle, right? Good men create good times, or strong men create good times. Good times create weak men create bad times. It's just really interesting. It almost feels like a lot of the maybe Latin American countries or Mexico or whatever is kind of in like, it's like we're at different parts in the cycle, you know, and like we're crossing. But interestingly, it also seems like a lot of this is merging globally, because despite the fact that there are still big chasms between cultures and you know, different language-based communities, they are falling away, and AI is kind of accelerating that. So I'm curious, like, kind of how you think of that. Do you think Mexico specifically? I'm sure you think it's in a better place than Canada, otherwise you wouldn't have moved there. But do you think it's in a upward or downward trend in kind of that cycle?
That's a great question, Guy. And I would, to be fairly honest, my vision on this has changed, right? When you mm-hmm. first moved to a specific place, you mostly see the benefits, and now 5 years in, I'm starting to see the bad side of Mexico, right? I think, mm-hmm. like, I would say Mexico is probably a better place than Canada if you're a very freedom-oriented individual. But if your concern is security, then Canada's definitely better than Mexico, right? There's no question there. So how do I see Mexico's evolution? So this is a very interesting topic, because there's a lot of signs that would make you think that it's going in the right direction, as much as there's a lot of signs that make you think it's going in the wrong direction. So for example, the political situation raises a lot of red flags, right? It seems that Mexico has elected this new regime that is very left-wing, but also very populist, nationalist. So it seems to have created this perfect coalition for ruling the country, very much opposed. Like the narrative, sometimes you listen to them, and it's like, it kind of sounds like Trump. You know, these, I'm fighting the uniparty state, these old mm-hmm. conservative liberal elites were just one uniparty, and now the populists have taken over. But from a left-wing perspective. And so you see a lot of risk there, right? The one-party state, they've completely changed the judiciary. There was like all judges are now elected by popular vote in Mexico. And last year or a year and a half ago, they all got fired and new ones got elected. And all the new ones are completely aligned with the party in power. So you see things like that, right? You see things like that. But at the same time, you talk to Mexicans And they're more educated than they've ever been, right? Mexico seems to have reached some levels of development. The technological sector is also very big. For example, you know, the startup program Y Combinator in the United States, one of the biggest ones, they have more Mexican founders than any single European country.
Really? Yeah, any single kidding.
You grab Germany, the UK, Mexico wins against any single country, right? So those things are kind of interesting. So I guess I'm hopeful because of the education and the entrepreneurs and the freedom oriented people in Mexico. But I'm always risk averse around politics and government, right? Like you should be anywhere. But I think Bitcoin brings an interesting opportunity to Latin America that has been kind of caught in a vicious cycle over the past century of, you know, being too radical on one side of politics, going too far to the left, then going too far on the right too, like, or at least on the like the right wing politics. Sometimes, let me tell you, it's sometimes synonymous with just organized crime. That is the problem of politics in Mexico. You think you elect the guy that's going to fix security, he's actually in bed with the narcos. So I don't know. And trust is a really important question.
That's usually what you get with rhinos. That's usually what it's just different cartels. It's just the military industrial complex.
Exactly.
The cartel industrial complex.
Exactly. But I'm hopeful Bitcoin can actually make a change to the Latin American region. You know, as we've seen, for example, in El Salvador, as we've seen with Argentina, I think there's hope that there can be change. And I think Mexico is probably on the other end because it has this new regime that is, but I'm hopeful that at least technology and a sense of entrepreneurship and Bitcoin and just liberating ideas and technologies will have an impact. But how do you solve trust, right? That remains to me the biggest question of the puzzle. There's this, every kid that grew up in Mexico is told some ideas of how they should behave in society. For example, there's this famous phrase, which in Spanish is el que no tranza no avanza, which means whoever doesn't cheat doesn't move forward. So you're taught as a kid to cheat the other guy because it's the only way you're going to succeed in life, right? So Mexicans, a lot of Mexicans are always constantly thinking life is a zero-sum game and they have to cheat the next guy. So how do you build trust around a society that is taught about that life is a zero-sum game, right? I think the solution is really you got to break the whole thing down apart and you got to build it from a sound money foundation, right? And then maybe you have a shot at building a better future. And that's the vision that I'm trying to push forward. But we're still battling Goliath here, right? And some things are just way harder to pull off in a country that's in a low trust society in the end. That's really the question.
Yeah. That's crazy. You know, it's one of those things. I watched a video where we were talking about like the leftist mindset that I thought was pretty accurate. If a leftist watched it, they'd probably think it was awful, and it was pretty demeaning in the way that it presented it. But it just screams accurate to me as someone who sees what I think is totally wrong with the right ideology, and then same with the left. Was that they project what they think about, you know, there's this like kind of white knight thinking that like, oh, I'm going to save immigrants, or I'm going to save everybody from Somalia or from Latin America or whatever. And they think they have empathy because they want to help these people. And they're like, we should all have free healthcare and we should have all of this stuff. And empathy is when you can actually get into the mindset and understand that other person's perspective and their culture. And it doesn't mean that you feel sorry for them. That's sympathy, right? Like empathy literally means, can you identify with them? Can you understand their perspective? And the leftist actually has no empathy whatsoever. That's the thing that they get angry about more than anything else. If you ask them to try to understand what a person on the right or what a libertarian or anybody else thinks, they're just like, well, they're evil pieces of shit and they just want everybody to die in the streets, right? Like they just want profit and they just want to cut everybody's legs off to sell extra meat and put it in your hamburgers. Like, it's the most idiotic, like childishly, like Disney cartoon evil perspective. I mean, anybody who even disagrees, right, they'll attack their own, even if they just step out of line for a second. Ask the wrong question and you'll get gutted. You'll just get your throat slit socially. So it's like the premier opposite. And it's so crazy that they talk about inclusivity and they talk about empathy when they could not be, and racism, when they could not be the more perfect demonstration of the most belligerent and hardened, like, opposites of all of those things. Like, they are perfectly racist. They are perfectly exclusive in every way, in every sense. They are entirely not even slightly empathetic. The wokeism is literally the opposite of everything that they claim. And so what they do is they don't, you know, they you know, just let's import a whole bunch of people from Latin America or Mexico, and they just never think about the fact that they grew up. Some of these people grew up in such low trust environments that their slogans are, if you don't cheat, you don't get ahead. You know, like, this is they live in a different world than they do. And it's wild that they cannot recognize that. And that, you know, Somalia is the whole Somali debate and situation with immigration is such a perfect example, because they grew up in such a vicious environment that they don't, their culture, generally speaking, doesn't care or even consider what the cost is, because they were always paying the cost. They just have the opportunity to be the one that gets the benefit of the cost. So it's like, why wouldn't you scam? Scam is life. Scam is natural. You know, everybody scams. It's just whether you're a scammer or a scammy. And I just don't want to be a scammy anymore. And so they come here and they take advantage. It's like, wow, wokeism is great. They're idiots. They have no idea who we are or where we come from. I get to be the scammer here. I get to be the rich scammer here. Like, that's what the land of opportunity is to a lot of those people. And I'm not saying that, like, everybody thinks that or they're all crappy people. That's not the point. I'm talking about a culture. Cultures grow up in environments. Cultures become norm because of experience. If your life experience is nothing but distrust and scam and hatred or cheating, then you're usually those things. You're usually those things. And the idea that you wouldn't have a filter, that you wouldn't think about whether you're importing the culture or you're importing someone who's trying to get away from the culture because they recognize the problems of it. And to be on either side, to think that, oh, everybody over there must be that culture because they have the same skin color. Like, that's retarded. But in the exact same way, it's like never even empathizing or thinking about what their perspective is or how they grew up. And then just saying, everybody, come on, everybody, welcome. We'll pay for you. Like, it's just like, how do you not realize the vast, that you're creating all of your own problems? 100%. You're creating all of your own problems. And I don't know. Random tangent. Sorry.
No, but totally. And I think Somalia is a particularly bad case, right? It's like probably the most extreme case. Mexico is a bit in between. I'm hopeful because I see more and more people that understand this, self-criticize their own culture, and want to move ahead. Yeah. And there's actually a way ahead. It's not like a completely broken state like Somalia, where you have basically no hope. Mexico is a sort of semi-functioning society, so there's hope, right?
It's like a back and forth, right? It's a pendulum, and you're like, we're going to swing back.
Right, right.
there's movement in every direction, so that means there's movement in the good, too.
Exactly.
So how do you deal with you've got the La Casa de Satoshi, and I'll ask the same question that I asked the guys at the Colorado Space. How the hell do you do that and have REO? You know, like, how do you, like, that just seems like a insert, like, just such a huge thing. How do you deal with the cost? Like, do you have, like, membership? Like, that just, I've felt and like have wanted to do it, but all I can think in my mind is that like I have to have a profitable business in front of it, you know, like a cafe or a something that I can basically make as like a loss, have the Bitcoin space as like a loss leader or something. Or I've thought about doing it as like a community thing, as you know, you have a gym and you have a your membership or whatever gets you a whole bunch of things that may or may not be related to Bitcoin. They're just about the community side of things. But I'm just curious. I'm curious how you think about it from a
right
profitability standpoint, and that this isn't just going to suck my life energy and my time and my money. Like what's the strategy? How do you make that? Obviously it's awesome, but how do you make it work?
This couldn't be a better question, because let me tell you how people don't understand the effort required to build such a thing. And you seem to understand that, right? So maybe I want to just take a step back and say that for years, me and my co-founders of Audio, who, by the way, are my best friends since high school in Montreal, and with whom I basically built everything in Bitcoin that I've done.
Yeah,
definitely. I consider myself lucky and blessed for that. But for years, we organized the Bitcoin Montreal meetup. So we knew what it was to organize a meetup. We were given the responsibility of the Bitcoin Montreal meetup by Francis Pouliot from Bull Bitcoin, who had started the meetup. This is one of the earliest Bitcoin meetups in the world, one of the biggest meetups. We had over even like 4,000 people that had come up to the event. And this was in 2018 when I started. There were already 4,000 members. So we knew that you had to constantly put in the work, right? And not necessarily expect a payback for a little while, right? So we come in with this energy, because we've seen so many communities rise up and fall because people expect a lot of feedback right away, right? They expect that's going to pay off right away. It's a long haul. You got to persist. So we come in with this energy, and we also come in with this startup, right? So for us, it's like, yeah, we can actually turn some of these people into customers to subsidize the whole thing. Also, we really don't want to, like I said, Satoshi, to be synonymous with Audio. It's in collaboration with other people. Yeah. And that would be a mistake, right? To just make it part of the company, because then you wouldn't invite other people to come in, right? So,
yeah.
So La Casa Satoshi, what is La Casa Satoshi? It's a physical space and a community in Mexico City that was founded not exactly by us, but a guy named Santiago, who, to be honest, had a lot of luck because his grandfather had a building in Mexico City where the third floor was emptied out. They used to have a big architectural firm. Now it's downsized. So they're like, oh, we got this whole floor. So he invested a bit of his money to make it renovated. So it's a beautiful place. Okay. And we work there. The Audio team and some other guys work there every day. And we pay rent to this space. And that's a little bit how we subsidize the physical space in part. But then that is just the basic, right? You get the space. You subsidize a little bit with some rent money from the co-work space. If you have a Bitcoin startup like ours, maybe the sweet spot would be to have like 3 Bitcoin startups in that space that pay rent. But then you actually got to put in the work to make events, promote it, right? Create content around it. And the events, you're going to have a whole schedule of events, right? For example, we have a monthly bid devs, but we also have a monthly 101. But every quarter, somehow we end up participating in a conference. For example, in January, we hosted the guys from the BitCon from Argentina. They came to Mexico City and we had 3 stages. The whole building was used for like with 3 different stages and like 25 presentations, right? So, a lot of effort went into that, right? Yeah. A lot of nights, like just sometimes even physical labor, right? So you cannot be scared to get your hands dirty. I'm the CEO of a startup that raised money, but I'm still, you know, pulling tables up and cleaning stuff up. But for us, it's really about you also gotta enjoy the social aspect out of it, right? If you got, like, for example, I got, and my co-founders, we got a lot of like social energy in the sense that if I talk to 100 people, I'm still enjoying it. I'm not like thinking, oh, I wanna go home and just sit by myself, my bad social battery is off, right? So you gotta have people that actually enjoy and have the energy to socialize. But you also gotta have a dream, right? Our dream is to that one day we'll be, we could even become a sort of a nationally recognized think tank that actually shapes policy of Mexico 10 years from now, right? When Bitcoin will have had a bigger impact in the world, people will actually listen to us to shape policy, to decide how to rebuild the culture. So that's, and it's a bit crazy, right? It will probably not happen, but we got to stick with this dream, this idea that maybe we can make a difference.
Got to have a target, you know?
Exactly.
Got to have a place you're headed. Yeah.
Exactly. And you got to invite other people to come in too. Like I said, if you're, it's just one company, it's not going to work out. If that company stops, the whole project's going to stop. So now what we're doing with La Casa Satoshi, because it was very informal between Santiago and his buddies and us, some other guys too, like Santiago's company. But now what we're going to do is we're going to set up a legal structure around it to make it a real not-for-profit, like civil association, and actually get other companies to pay, like, let's say, like a monthly subscription or payment. So we got this whole business plan. We're going to take a shot out of it because we want to formalize it. And let's say if I move to another place, if my company shuts down, then this project can still survive
without it. Yeah.
So yeah, so that's the idea, right? But to be honest, it's not like I got it figured out and like I got the recipe.
Sure.
This is how we're gonna build a million Bitcoin communities around the world. No, it's really out of the, you gotta have, it's like being a founder, right? You gotta have some irrational belief and confidence that you're gonna be successful at it. So plus you gotta love it, right? I love the mission. I couldn't be prouder of what I do. I also want to say that there was this bar in Mexico City called the Bitcoin Embassy Bar that this girl Lorena Ortiz founded about 5-6 years ago, who had built a Bitcoin community there, and she shut down a month before La Casa Satoshi opened, and she's a great friend of ours. So a lot of the community that she built translated to us. So we were also, and it was about the same time we launched Audio. So it all just happened at the same time, right? The stars aligned.
Passing of the torch, right?
Exactly. The stars aligned. So we also, there's also a luck component all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude, it's funny. You mentioned being a founder and you have to have an irrational optimism. It's funny because, you know, you say, and it's my inclination too to call it like an irrational belief that you'll succeed, right? Because generally speaking, against all odds, likelihood is no. And but it's also funny. You can kind of think about this from first principles, but I've also seen, like, you know, people explain at length like why it is. It's like, no, you. The irrational optimism, the irrational belief that you are just going to take over the world or you're going to succeed isn't even, not only is it not irrational, really, you actually can't succeed without it. Like there's no way for you to hold the perspective necessary to make the decisions that would need to happen for success. You know, so it's quote unquote irrational optimism isn't simply like a, you know, convince yourself that you can succeed. You will not succeed, whether or not, probability all aside, you will simply not succeed if you do not hold that irrational belief. And that's a little bit why entrepreneurs are all a little bit psycho. I think there's like a little bit of course. I don't know. It's like partial autism, partial insanity, like it just because holy crap, man, especially like what I've been doing for the last 2 to 3 years, oh my god, if I wasn't I mean, you know, at some point I guess I will have to throw in the towel and switch gears if it doesn't make a return. But man, you have to be crazy. Like, you have to be a little bit nuts.
A little bit to
actually pay the price to go the full the full stretch to some sort of conclusion just to see if it's going to work.
Right, because you could just get disappointed and give up so many times, yeah. Right? Like, let me tell you.
Oh, I've been there like four times. I've been there like four times.
Of course. Like, I've done meetups.
What was your most epic? I almost gave up.
Well, I mean, I sort of gave up my first startup, right? We had a startup in Canada called Verify. We had a platform people can buy and sell Bitcoin back in 2019, 2020. And so, like, and was Bitcoin only, self-custody, mm-hmm. Concierge service, right? Kind of what the Swan and the Unchained guys succeeded at later. We had built this, and then we associated with Bull Bitcoin, and that worked out for a little while, but it wasn't the same as just being a founder. So when I tried to like re-pick up, I thought the momentum had passed. You know, you kind of have the idea sometimes they're like, maybe it's too late. Maybe all the exchanges in Canada are already shaped mm-hmm. up and I'm not going to make a difference, when it was actually just the beginning. Like mm-hmm. Most of the companies that are the biggest one in the Bitcoin only ecosystem today barely existed then. So now I'm just always convincing myself, like, if I get tempted to have the idea that like, it's too late, a Bitso already dominates the market, people are not going to change their mind, nobody cares about Bitcoin, they just want the quick money. When I get these thoughts in my head, which they obviously always pop up, well, I just gotta, like, once again, pick up that irrational optimism of like, no, this is just like I was telling myself 8 years ago that it was too late, but it obviously wasn't, right? So mm-hmm. I still think we're at the beginning of this Bitcoin journey. And I always gotta remind myself of that. And remember what I felt then and what happened after, to get a better perspective of how I'm going to feel a few years from now, right? Versus today. Also, for example, once I lived in Querétaro, which is a smaller city than Mexico City, and I used to organize Bitcoin meetups there. We had this Bitcoin Querétaro meetup. 3 people would show up, right? And it would be very disappointing to go from Montreal crowd with 100, 150 people to actually get like 3 guys, my founders and like 2 other guys show up to a Bitcoin meetup. And it's like, what? So we moved to the big city. That was part of the solution. But yeah, you just got to keep going. And one day it'll pay off. And if it doesn't, at least you had fun, right? That's really it.
Yeah. And it's probably a good example too, that you verify your other company, is that you're now doing the same thing a second time, right? Like, learning what didn't work the first time, but headed towards the same goal. And you've got a really interesting and what seems like a pretty unique tool in the whole space, is that like, you can just send money to a bank account and it shows up in your Lightning wallet. And I can send a Lightning wallet to an address that's associated with my bank, and then boom, it's there on my card. It's there in the bank. Like, that is pretty wild. That's pretty awesome.
Thank you, Guy.
And I'm curious too, what do you do on the Lightning side? Do y'all use, I could be confusing projects, but do you guys work with the Breeze SDK?
No, we actually work with LightSpark.
LightSpark. Okay. Well, that's what Breeze SDK uses, right? Is Spark. Or no, it's LightSpark and Spark are different.
Yeah, exactly. So LightSpark is like an enterprise product.
Damn it, people.
No, but it's the same company. LightSpark and Spark is the same company. Yes.
Okay.
Just Spark is their like state chain layer mm-hmm. 2 project, and LightSpark is their enterprise API, right? So we use LightSpark. To be honest, this would be a great content piece if someone is listening to this. Comparison of Lightning, like a system, enterprise system for Lightning, right? You mm-hmm. got River that provides like their Lightning service, but you also got, used to have ZBD, not so much, LightSpark, Voltage, Emboss, right? And it's a bit opaque what is the best for such a use case. LightSpark is pretty good. It's what like the biggest exchanges use, right? So it works well if you don't want to bother managing liquidity and things like that. So we use LightSpark for all lightning.
Will it do splicing? Or does that depend on like what the user has? Let's say I have a Lightning wallet with my channel, right? And I try to receive $300 worth out of the bank account, and I've only got $200 worth of liquidity. What actually happens there? Does it just notify me and be like, you need more liquidity, or like how does that work?
Yeah, exactly. So that's really on the user's end, right? We cannot, because that's the incoming liquidity.
Obviously, if it's self-custody, you can't really do anything with it, but yeah.
Right. I would tell you that the sad reality, Guy, is that Lightning is mostly used in a custodial or semi-custodial manner, right? So we haven't encountered that much those situations because most people are using non-custodial, like custodial setups, right? So where the big provider or semi-custodial ones or like guided ones like Phoenix, where they receive it and Phoenix manages their liquidity, right? So, but yeah, technically, if someone was receiving it on their own node, they would have, and they have an incoming liquidity issue, that would be on them. If someone's sending us Lightning and we cannot receiving, that's because we don't have incoming liquidity, that's on us. But it has never happened because LightSpark like manages all that by themselves. And yeah, LightSpark is based on LDK. And it's actually the founder of Lightning, Taj, the guy that wrote, he's one of the engineers that built the LightSpark setup based on LDK, which is like based on Rust Lightning. So you get all the benefits that are from Rust Lightning and LDK. You basically get them under the hood in LightSpark, which means like splicing and things like that.
Nice. Yeah, I've been really impressed with, I'm pretty sure Phoenix uses the LDK, if I'm not mistaken.
No, Phoenix has its own implementation called Eclair, which is one of the four main implementations.
Oh, wow, that's right. I forgot.
Yeah.
Man, it's so hard to keep up with what tools being used where. But I've been super jazzed about the Breeze SDK and Spark's state chain stuff just because it allows self-custody with an address, right? With like receive offline, which I just think is a massive unlock that people, like, I think this is the main reason why like you say, is that most people use custodial. I really think that's it because like if I'm not using Wallet of Satoshi or I don't have a start nine, it's just always online with channels and stuff. Right. I can't receive, you know?
Exactly.
And like that kills, I mean, there's your feature gone, you know, like there's the whole idea of direct to wallet gone. If you don't have essentially a custodial thing with the DNS and all that stuff.
Right.
And, it's interesting. I'm curious your take on this, is how you see, because you're building for self-custody, right? You're building for direct integration and to basically give the Bitcoiner experience, making it possible. So how do you think about the fact that so many people are using custodial? And do you see this as a step in the wrong direction? Do you like what's your perspective on this? And if you want, I can kind of give you some of my own thoughts afterward. But I want to get your take on where the state of Lightning and custody and all these things are, because I think most people are just like super poo-poo about it. They're like, oh, it's terrible. And Lightning's not, none of the promises of Lightning are even working and nothing's being fixed. You know, we're just getting fiat with different branding. I think that's wrong, but I want to know how you see it, especially from the perspective of a builder and somebody with a company having to use these things hands on.
Thank you for the question, Guy. So the way I see it from watching, I have multiple perspectives because I told you I also write the Bitcoin Optic newsletter. So I got that perspective too. But from like founding Audio and having users use Lightning, from what I'm seeing is, yes, it's mostly custodial, right? People are using the custodial ones, but there's a new wave of wallets that are using, let's say, the Breeze SDK of similar technologies, where they're actually holding wallet funds in either Liquid or now Spark and now Arc even, right? And that I think is really cool, right? For example, the I use Blitz Wallet a lot, which behind the doors, it kind of uses either, if I recall correctly, Arc or Spark. So it uses Lightning to receive, but it holds the balance in Arc instead of having to deal with channel liquidity. So I think that is one direction where the market's going to go, hopefully, right, is through these abstractions of Lightning or other layers on top of Bitcoin that have different trust assumptions. But for example, in the case of Arc, I think it's a pretty good balance. However, if I look at it from the perspective of the guy that I am that writes the Bitcoin Uptick newsletter, specifically the changes to the Bitcoin Core and LND and the code that is added to these software stacks, well, I see a lot of evolution in all these Lightning implementations. They all seem to share the same goal. How can we make it easier to hold a self-custodial Lightning balance, right? With things, for example, as asynchronous payments, which you were saying, how can I have a self-custodial wallet if I'm offline? Well, that's exactly what the LDK team has been working on for 6 months, asynchronous payments, so that you have this LSP that holds on to this payment for you in a non-custodial manner. And as soon as you come back online, it ships it to you, right? So there's these technologies that are still getting built. When people tell me like Bitcoin doesn't evolve, it's like it couldn't be more false, right? We had all this work being done at the like protocol or software, like elementary software level, that I think in a few years we're gonna be in a pretty good spot. Maybe we're gonna have like, and even from the custodial wallet end, for example, Wallet of Satoshi now has a Spark mode where you can actually write down a seed phrase for your Spark wallet. And yes, Spark is not the perfect trust assumption scenario, but it's still better than fully custodial. So I think
you have the ability to exit without the Spark provider, you know, like you have a unilateral exit option. Like the people who don't recognize, like there's a huge issue with, like, I really think a big part of it is failure to recognize or kind of accept the limitations and path to scaling is understanding like how technology scales, and that centralization is always the quick fix to the technological gap, and that every solution is going to have to be layered. Like Bitcoin scaled trust, Bitcoin scaled consensus, but it didn't scale payments, it didn't scale features, it didn't scale wallet tools, you know, like it just scaled trust and consensus. And that was something that had never been solved before. And it explicitly did it by limiting the scale of all of those other things, by limiting the capacity to do all of those things that Charles Hoskinson talked about in like why it wasn't going to succeed. No, that's literally why it was going to succeed. But in doing so, it meant that the first 200,000 daily users of Bitcoin were going to have an experience that you could just put up an address and receive to that address, and everything was going to work. And it was going to seem like we've solved payments for retail for the whole freaking world. But you didn't. You solved it for about 200,000 people a day. And now you've reached a limit. There's like 8 billion people on the planet. So you got to figure something else out for the next layer. And then when you implement something like Lightning, well, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to be custodial. It is first going to go to custodial, especially if it requires an always online entity, because it's going to enable a way for instant and feature rich payments between all of the institutions that do have to stay online, between the ones that do have to have payments. Think about the fact, like I you know, people who say it was like, oh, it was supposed to disrupt Visa. Well, it kind of is. From the business perspective, not the user perspective, like the service provider is their relationship is being disrupted because the service provider actually owns the money they get. Like if I'm a custodian for 100,000 people with Lightning wallets, yes, those 100,000 people don't hold their own keys, but I as a business hold my keys. That's wild. In fiat land, that is unheard of. I don't own the shit in Visa. I don't own the shit in my bank account. I don't own the dollars from the Federal Reserve or the pesos from the Mexican Central Bank. I don't own any of that shit. I can't own any of that shit. But the idea that the next layer down can actually obtain sovereignty and then provide sovereignty-derived services to people in a way that they've never been able to access from any other entity or institution anywhere on Earth, because it's the first time we've had a consensus network that could provide such an insane thing. And then not to realize that, like, oh, well, then you figure out how to get unilateral exit and extend the supply guarantees down to the next layer, and you build something like ARC or Spark or state chains, you know, like that's when. And then suddenly you do have, like, we're what, 16 years into this, so almost 17 years into this. And holy shit, we're getting it to the user in a unilateral way that ensures the scarcity and the security of consensus. That's a fucking huge win. That's a huge win. You know, I just, like, to not be optimistic about the tech and the systems and the networks is unbelievable to me, just because, like, a lot of people are on custodial lightning wallets. It's like, well, no shit. Like, it's two of 15 layers that we have to build, you know? Like, we're talking about replacing a monetary and financial system for the world. Do you have any idea how many moving pieces there are in that fucking thing? And, like, we're starting from zero. We can't use any of that shit. We're starting from zero. It's like we're going back to, oh, we invented a new type of metal, and now we have to start with trains. And it's like, well, nobody's flying around on jets yet. It's like, well, no shit, we're still building rails. But anyway, long rant, but it just, I'm shocked by the number of people who are like, feel hopeless. They're like, are giving up, you know? It's like, man, the race hadn't even started. Like, we just got the first lap. This is the Indy 500. We are one lap around the damn track. Like, this is going to take generations. Like,
100%.
If you're throwing in the towel, somebody else is just going to pick it up, and you're just going to be left behind. But anyway.
100%. No, I couldn't agree more, Guy. And this is what I tell people. People tell me about, like, the things you cover on Bitcoin Optech. They're kind of boring. Like, they're not these ZK snarks, cool features like on the Ethereum newsletter. But I'm like, that's exactly the point. Like, this is so important. You got to build every little aspect of it very carefully, even as boring as it might be, because this is just so important. I couldn't agree more. But I'm very excited of what we're doing in the community space with, like, as a Satoshi, where we're building with audio. This is not only this is just our first products. We really wanted to cover the surface first, right? Just build the self-custodial experience first. But we're gonna come up with other things. Now our focus is wanna be more on the business side of things, because, for example, you got companies in the US like River signing up thousands of businesses that to buy Bitcoin for their business treasury. In Mexico and other countries, I see absolutely no business adoption. People are kind of scared. Like, how does it work fiscally, right? Things like that. Mm-hmm. So we and plus there exists no business tool, right? It's really just about getting the retail to gamble. So people, even the crypto companies are not shipping business features, but we think we can make a difference there, right? And just in the whole space, everything that I'm seeing lately, I think we're entering a Bitcoin golden era with all the new technologies we're discovering. Because for the first decade, Bitcoin was still very, for at least for the first 5-6 years, there was so little capital in the industry that not a lot was getting built. Plus, Bitcoin still had all these early on issues. Now we're getting to the moment where Bitcoin is extremely solid. It's more than, it's a trillion-dollar industry, right? Or a trillion-dollar asset. So I think we're just entering the golden era.
Yeah. You know, that might be a good place to end it. I've got a couple things, and I know somebody's about to be here with the construction team. So cutting it a little bit early, but I want to know any last thoughts. I love that, that we're about to enter the golden era of Bitcoin, because I kind of feel the same way. I'm like, the people who are kind of like depressed or like acting like we've lost something, or like, I'm just like, nah, man, we just started winning. You know? it might not feel that way because like the price or you're focused on politics every day, right, you know, whatever it is that you care about. Like, but what are you, that's your choice, you know, like what are you choosing to pay attention to? I'm curious, any final thoughts or anything you want to point people to, or maybe if you wanted to, I'll phrase it this way. If you wanted to give the audience something to take away, like a little bit of perspective or something that they want to walk away from this holding on to, what is that piece of advice or what is that perspective?
Well, what I would say is that the things that I saw very early on when I was starting to get into Bitcoin and building products in Bitcoin, such as guys that come up to me in Canada in 2019 being like, hey, I'm this is a new perspective, or people using our product then and being like, wow, self-custody is really powerful. I'm still seeing that every day. I'm seeing people, even in this bear market, we're seeing people every day come to us at the meetup or use our products and be like, wow, I've never seen anything like this. This article you guys wrote, this presentation you did really changed my perspective on how money works and how the world works. And now I really just want to get Bitcoin into my own wallet and be sovereign, right? So I think that when you're in the ground and you're talking to people, you actually see how much of an impact is still being had in everyone's brain to this day. So that keeps me optimistic, right? Because I see the value that we're bringing and the impact we're having on people, and maybe others that are not so present in communities or working at Bitcoin companies are maybe not seeing that and maybe thinking that we're kind of reached a cap to the potential Bitcoin has, when I would absolutely disagree with it. So I'm expecting, in the next bull run, I'm expecting a whole an explosion of interest. You know, the idea that retail has capped its interest on Bitcoin, I disagree, right? I think we're still in the early days. I still think we got millions of people that are going to turn into Bitcoiners over the next few years. And if anybody's in Mexico City, I would invite them to come join us at the La Casa Satoshi. It's really one of the best spots that I've been for Bitcoin community. And if anyone's in Mexico, I invite them to test out Audio.
Heck yeah. Heck yeah, man. Dude, thanks for coming on the show. This is a great combo.
Thank you so
much. I really appreciated it, man. All right. Well, I will point to all this stuff. We'll have links to all of it in the show notes. And appreciate it, man. I'll keep in touch. Hit me up on DMs or whatever if you got any updates or any other things you want me to check out.
Sounds great, Guy.
Yeah, love to refresh this in like a year or something. I'm sure you guys have lots of other cool shit up your sleeve.
That would be great. Thank you so much, Guy. I'm very grateful for you inviting me on.
Hell yeah, man. All right, dude. Later. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. I will have links and details all down in the show notes, as well as a discount code for our sponsor and the Bitbox O2 Nova down there as well, which is a great way to support the show and also save money and keep your keys safe. I highly recommend Bitbox. Really, really love those guys. And it's such a cool device if you haven't had one. Also, Gustavo will be sending me a bunch of links to check out. So anything that he wanted to point you to or anything that you're interested in, if you want to explore it, the description will have basically everything you need. And also for the Audionauts, we will have we talked a little bit before the show, and then I also got into a few things after the show. So we have some exclusive content for the Audionauts. So anybody over there, check that out. Go check out the Telegram or the Keat Room. I'll have it posted in both. There's some really fun insights just on kind of investment perspective and building a company in Bitcoin that I really wanted to get into with him. And we didn't do it on the show. We did it on the after show. So thank you guys so much. And that should do us for today. Don't forget to just follow him, myself. Check out the YouTube channel. We have some big changes coming and some new content types on the way. So stay tuned for that. I'm super, super excited. And I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan. And until then, everybody, that is my two sats.